Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, campaigners from India, Western Sahara, Australia and England will start dropping in. They'll be bringing us stories and experiences that are too often missed by mainstream media. Where high tech has killed 200,000 farmers. Why we're asked to stomach silver. And how supermarkets are not so super. I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine, and I'm joined today by environmentalist extraordinaire Dr. Vandana Shiva. As a world-renowned scientist based in northern India, she's a powerful and passionate advocate protecting food supplies. As an environmentalist who sees at first hand how corporations are carving up farms and farmers, she set up a remarkable legacy to humanity, a seed bank to protect biodiversity. In protest against transnational takeovers of food markets, she's recently been building the Movement for Retail Democracy. Why, Vandana?
Well, giant corporations like Walmart started to try and enter India after the United States government and the government of India signed a very strange-sounding treaty, a bilateral agreement called U.S.-India Knowledge Initiative in Agriculture. But on the board of this bilateral are Walmart and Monsanto and Cargill and Conagra, and it's basically a takeover of seed by Monsanto, a takeover of trade by Cargill and the other agribusiness, and an attempt to take over India's retail market, which gives direct employment to more than 400 million people, the vegetable vendors who walk down our streets and bring our brinjals and potatoes to our doorstep, the clothes vendors, the markets that are set up weekly. This is a direct assault to what I call India's retail democracy, deep democracy of the kind where we have direct relationships between buyers and sellers, and these are community relationships. I know my sabjiwala, my vegetable vendor. I know when he'll come. He knows what we like. This is not a pure anonymous retail relationship. This is really an extension of the family. So the Movement for Retail Democracy was started both to defend the livelihoods of millions as well as to defend an India that's livable rather than the horrible India of box stores.
I understand that 5,000 farmers and small retailers protested against Walmart in Delhi recently. What market share could small farmers and retailers lose if stores like Walmart take hold in India, Vandana?
You know, very often these issues are calculated on an arithmetic basis, as if a market is a piece of cake, and if Walmart gets 10%, the remainder will stay at 90%. And it's exactly the same argument that's made that if Cargill gets the wheat market or soya, edible oil market of 2%, 3%, it won't damage the rest. It does, because these are processes. Basically, when a seed corporation like Monsanto enters, it might enter in a small way, but its entry involves the dismantling of the public seed supply. When a Cargill enters the Indian grain supply, its entry involves the dismantling of our wholesale distributors and our trading systems, which has led to a crisis where, on the one hand, farmers are not getting a decent enough price, and on the other hand, food prices have doubled. So when a Walmart enters, the studies say they will only have 10%, but they will dismember society in such a way that there will be none of the other retail democracy. And what will happen is the poor will be left unserved, because the poor will not go to supermarkets.
It's so refreshing to hear somebody say that, Vandana. We are always taught to think so much in the rich world about that market share. In India, I understand the protest movement is very strong, that people are hitting the streets, and there's coalitions of farmers as well as small retailers working together in resistance to supermarkets. Can you tell us about those campaigns and where they're springing up, and what are the farmers and the retailers asking for?
The movement for retail democracy, you know, I've kind of picked the name because I realized not only that we have retail democracy in this country that has to be defended, but that we have to build a retail democracy movement, which has to be a rainbow coalition of people who have usually not worked together and often been antagonistic. You know, the small vendor on the street and the shopkeeper have never had the same interest, and the farmer and the trader have not had the same interest. But in the larger context today, they do. And putting together this coalition took us a few months. It has the retail trade in terms of shopkeepers and the trade associations. It involves the hawkers, as they're called. I hate that word, hawker. I think it's a horrible British word. It's basically people who sell on the street, who celebrate the street as the commons. I would really call them those who recover and reclaim the commons for us. And, of course, the small peasants and farmers, and also children, because it's the youth who are targeted for coming to these supermarkets and shopping malls. The broad alliance now is asking for no corporate entry into retail. And that includes also the Indian corporations who are watching the Walmartization phenomena. I think they can get a piece of the pie. Reliance, which is the big corporate giant, which if you counted the family as one, the two brothers, who are third and fourth right now, I think, in the richest men on the planet, if you count the two brothers together, they actually outdo Warren Buffett. They wanted to get into vegetable selling, and we always have this joke when we give speeches. Why are the rich so desperate? Why do they have to now descend to vegetable selling? Let them keep their refineries and petrochemical plants. Let them at least leave the vegetables to the small player. And Rajasthan just passed a law, Uttar Pradesh passed a law saying corporations will not be allowed into the retail sector. So the movement is having an impact.
Yes. I'd like to talk about government reaction in a moment, but I'm wondering too whether the actual breadth of the campaign is creating other things other than just opposition to supermarkets. I'm thinking as you're speaking, it sounds like real communities of people are setting up that might have secondary benefits that weren't anticipated.
You know, Navdanya, the movement I started for seed saving and organic farming has over the last decade been creating an alternative model for retail, which is retail directly by the farmers. The producers become the sellers without having to hand over 50, 60% profits. I'll just give you a very simple example. The difference between the price of wheat that the farmer got and what a consumer paid in India 5 years ago used to be only 50 rupees. That's €1, $1. Today it is 250 rupees, and that's €5, and that additional profit is all going to agribusiness. And they are pushing the farmer down and the prices of food up. So the direct marketing means the farmers get more, and the consumer doesn't have to pay too much for the best quality food, knowing exactly who's producing it. I have told the Hawkers Association that work with us in Delhi and in Calcutta that when they are ready, I would love for street vendors who take their push carts. You know, we've used the push cart as the logo because to me it's the ultimate solution to climate change.
Yes.
No driving to the supermarket.
Yes.
Here's a zero fossil fuel instrument that someone pushes and brings to your doorstep.
Yes.
The push cart vendor. My dream is that in a few months' time, they'll be ready to turn to becoming distributors from the farmers directly to the houses and kitchens of people. But meantime, we are having to work on the fact, and this is where the issue of how much of a market share does Walmart or Reliance get. The point is when these corporations enter, they create laws that disenfranchise the small player. They don't fight on a level playing field. They make the playing field highly unlevel by criminalizing the small trader. So there are issues of banning street foods. And interestingly, there's a horrible phenomenon called sealing. The British started it in their times, but it has suddenly resurrected. The Chief Justice, his sons were involved in building malls and supermarkets. So he gives an order that all economic activity within the city will be shut down. Can you imagine the households who have lost their economic livelihood? So right now, the poor vendors and hawkers are struggling against this criminalization. And what I have told them they need to do is declare with the local community their presence in a place. The state cannot be a fascist force helping the giant supermarkets. The community has to be the protecting force to say, we are a self-organized democratic retail. We know this vendor works here. We like this vendor to come and sell vegetables to us, or a dry cleaner, or a chemist in our neighborhood, that these licenses should come from local associations of citizens.
Yes, because to ban street hawking, to ban street trade, you have to have the governments on side. You've said that four of the governments have now banned corporate incursion into India. What type of reaction are you getting from the Indian government nationally?
The federal government, the national government is totally for it. The national government is totally for neoliberal policies. And it's because we have the protests and we have the movement. They haven't been able to open up for direct participation of Walmart and the global giants in the retail. So they're allowing them cash and carry, which eventually ends up being wholesale pretending to be retail. And so far, Walmart hasn't started yet because we've had these massive protests. So unfortunately, whether you look at retail or you look at the agricultural scenario, the federal government is totally pro-corporate, and it's the regional governments who are able to listen a little more to the ground and respond a little better.
Looking at the corporate entity itself, a corporate entity like Walmart, what other problems do you think it will bring to India?
I think, first and foremost, a giant supermarket of that kind of volume cannot bring you fresh spinach every day. You know, they must necessarily bring the toxic chain and the high fossil fuel chain. And in fact, in the studies we did when we did the campaign, we did calculations of how much additional carbon emissions would take place if instead of the vegetable vendor coming on foot, sitting under the shade of a tree, you had these giant box stores emitting carbon dioxide, trying to refrigerate vegetables at 50 degrees centigrade, shunting them around thousands of miles to bring them from where they are grown to where they are. Of course, Walmart will do exactly what it has done elsewhere to Indian farmers, increase its margin and bring everyday low prices by bringing everyday low prices to farmers. That burden of a downward spiral will be devastating. In any case, our studies have shown that when corporations trade, they cannot deal with half-acre farmers. They have to deal with other corporations. So what starts to happen is agriculture starts to get corporatized. In Punjab right now, there are massive land conflicts over corporations taking over farmlands and then supplying to the Tescos. And what we would see is more destruction of the peasant economy of India, larger emergence of agribusiness in India to then become the large volume suppliers to the Walmart.
Yes, it's a similar story in rich world countries where supermarkets are on every horizon. The list of losses that their dominance brings is a long one, destroying local economies, eating up countrysides, encouraging car culture, and decreasing food quality. Andrew Sims has just dropped into our airwaves from London. He's just written Tescopoly, how one shop came out on top and why it matters. From where you sit in England, Andrew, why does it matter?
I think it matters for a number of reasons. First of all, there's a direct cultural impact that the rise and rise of the chain stores, exemplified by the supermarkets, has on the quality of life in the places where we live. We've seen in Britain the length and breadth of the country, once distinctive and interesting places to live, gradually falling beneath the phenomenon of what we've called the clone town, where you can walk up and down a high street pretty much anywhere in the country, and because you're seeing the same names and predominantly the various outlets of the supermarkets, you almost could be anywhere at any time. And it's either you're trapped in a clone town or the complete opposite, where the large hypermarket-type versions of the supermarkets have so sucked the economic life out of the centre of the towns that you've seen shops closing left, right and centre, somewhere where the local economy has been so undermined that it almost becomes a ghost town. And one of the problems is that after town centres have been killed off, there's a new trend in which some of the smaller outlets of the supermarkets have re-entered the high street. But of course the problem is there, that because of their economic structure, because they have to satisfy the profit needs of their remote shareholders, you see pound for pound, money spent in these big national or internationally integrated chain stores, leaving the local economy as if the shop is acting like a giant economic vacuum cleaner, sucking wealth and spending out. Whereas study after study has shown that shops which are genuinely locally owned and unoperated tend to have a much higher local multiplier effect. That is to say that for every pound spent in them, more of that money will stay and recirculate in the local area. Now, this is especially important where areas have a higher proportion of low-income households, and it's important to capture and keep the wealth that they have to offer. And then, of course, the bigger impact is that the way in which the big supermarkets save money and increase their profits is by driving costs out of the system. And if you looked at that as an economist in a very abstract way, you'd say, well, that's a good thing. But then you have to ask, what are the costs that are being driven out of the system? And of course, the costs are the livelihoods of the producers and the suppliers who fill the shelves of the supermarkets, and also the jobs in the retail sector overall. And again, numerous studies have shown that there's a net loss of jobs in the retail sector that happen as the stranglehold of the supermarkets and their market share in the sector gets bigger and bigger. So there are cultural effects, there are effects on the quality of life in communities and neighborhoods, there are economic effects both at the local level and at the national level.
Of course, Tesco is the English supermarket giant. It has, last time I looked, a whopping 30% of the British grocery market and stores in all but four postcodes. Let's go into the boardroom, Andrew. For instance, does the board of directors actually plan to wipe out the local retailers surrounding their stores?
I think there's two answers to that. One is a logical consequence and yet a paradox of a lightly regulated so-called free market system is that ultimately it tends towards monopoly. And that's clearly what's been happening in the British retail sector. Tesco's market share has actually increased slightly from the figures that you've quoted, and they're now the largest overall shop across all sectors, not including just groceries, and they take somewhere between £1 in 7, £1 in 8 of everything spent in British shops today.
That's amazing. That's huge.
It is absolutely huge. But I think there's another answer to your question, and that is that we've seen in sector after sector, shops like Tesco, and Tesco in particular, quite specifically targeting particular other retail competitors to try and take over the market dominant position. One particular example in that was a leading traditional, but itself fairly large, high street chemist called Boots. And Boots was seen as occupying a very important market position because it was a trusted pharmacist that sold a range of baby care products and therefore was a way of hooking in young mothers who Tesco's as a supermarket retailer saw as being absolutely their core market. So in that example, Tesco's went out strategically to take on Boots as the country's leading pharmacist and to capture that market position, and they did it extremely successfully. And when you look around sector after sector, whether it's in control of the milk supply chain or whether it's in the selling of newspapers and magazines or moving into the pharmacy sector, the big supermarkets in general and Tesco's in particular have deliberately targeted other sectors to take over the position of market dominance. And when you get to a certain size, the amount of information you have, the amount of financial leverage you have, creates a very uneven playing field and means that there's not any more any meaningful sense in which smaller players, micro, small and medium scale enterprises, can effectively compete anymore.
So you've just talked about strategic takeovers. What are the other types of decisions that are being made at a boardroom level that help cement Tesco in its monopoly position?
Lots of different ways in which you can look at it. Because you have to look at their overall marketing strategies, you'd look at their business strategies, you'd look at the way in which they're able to benefit from a lot of implicit subsidies to the transport infrastructure system that they can benefit from. But one particularly interesting and little understood one is merely the fact that when you get to a certain scale, the amount of money you have in effect as a free loan from your suppliers gets bigger and bigger and bigger, for the simple fact that Tesco's will be paid for the products that they sell through their shops before they themselves have to pay the suppliers back. It means that at any point in time over the last couple of years, Tesco's are operating in effect with a free loan of over £2 billion worth of income.
Wow.
From sales. Now, there's no way the smaller players can compete with that, and it means that it sets in train this self-reinforcing market dominant position. They've got the money, they've got the land. Tesco's, according to City Analysts at the moment, have already got the financial assets and the land to double their UK floor space. And bear in mind, once again, you've already pointed out they've got over 30% of UK grocery sector already, and they've got the capacity to double their floor space already. So unless there's a meaningful intervention from the regulator, there is nothing to stop the stranglehold over British retail getting tighter and tighter. It's a problem that the regulators, I think, have simply not addressed. That scale in and of itself, regardless of how you run your business, gives you an unfair advantage in the marketplace. And that's why we think that there needs to be a much stronger approach to competition policy, both at the national, international, and local levels, in order to maintain an open market. And I think it's a challenge to regulators of all sorts to say, how will you keep the market open so that everyone from sole operators through to micro, small, and medium-scale enterprises, and especially those which bring added economic and social value to the local economy because they are in and of the local community and rooted in the local community, how can you have a regulatory system that reflects the disproportionately greater benefit that they bring to the community, which is not recognised in the way that the market is regulated, or rather not regulated, at the moment?
Crossing the Atlantic Ocean for a moment, how does Tesco compare in profile with its United States cousin, Walmart?
Tesco's is a minnow in comparison to Walmart. But what's interesting is there's clearly aspects of the Walmart model that Tesco's have been following. And that gives you a hint of what the future in a country like Britain might look like. There's a term that the Americans have to describe the way in which the great suburban sprawling housing states have their needs met by the big box retail parks, which the petrol-hungry, people-carrier-type large family vehicles ferry backwards and forwards from the big suburban sprawl housing estates to the big retail parks. And the Americans have a term they use to describe this kind of development. They call it the dead zone, because by centralizing the economic activity in the big out-of-town or out-of-suburban sprawl retail parks, you're effectively surgically removing economic life from the heart of community. And that's a bleak future that Britain would have to look forward to if that's the route we continue to go down, as we appear to be going down at the moment.
That was Andrew Sims, Policy Director of the New Economics Foundation and author of Tescopoly, How One Shop Came Out on Top and Why It Matters. Andrew, great that you could join us on the program today. Thank you very much. That was illuminating.
Good stuff. Cheers.
Bye-bye. Bye. That was Bahu Dur Dur on Mahimi, an extraordinary melting pot of music by two of the world's best slide guitarists, Debashi Bhattacharya from India and Bob Brosman, bringing in his signature strains from the Pacific. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're talking with Vandana Shiva from the Indian-based Navdanya, a movement that she set up in 1991 to counter corporate control of the food chain. I understand that Navdanya has worked with 300,000 farmers. In what way has your work helped them?
When I started Navdanya, which means nine seeds, and it can also mean the new gift, it was basically to have an alternative to the emerging monopolies of the giant corporations who were taking over biotechnology, the seed companies. These were the old chemical giants like Monsanto, like Syngenta, and the idea that all seed and all life on the earth would be patented and genetically manipulated by them was so abhorrent to me, given that I spent all my life defending the diversity of plants and trees and crops. So I thought I'd start creating community seed banks so that farmers could not be criminalized for saving and sharing seeds, because patents on seed, intellectual property rights on seed, in effect says a farmer saving seed is a thief, a farmer sharing seed with a neighbor is a thief. And I could not accept this immoral order, took inspiration from Gandhi, who disobeyed the salt laws of the British and said, nature gives it for free, we will continue to make the salt for our survival and our needs. We will disobey our salt laws. And that is the spirit with which I started Navdanya. We set up more than 35 community seed banks across the country. And in any place where Navdanya has worked, not a single suicide has taken place. Because when farmers have their own seeds and do organic farming, there's no question of them getting into debt and committing suicide.
We should say that 200,000 farmers have committed suicide as a result of biotech in the cotton industry in particular. Is that right, Vandana?
Yes. If you make a map of the suicides, it has a one-to-one correspondence with the cotton belt, and increasingly the cotton belt is becoming a BT cotton belt. BT is a genetically engineered cotton that Monsanto monopolizes. It has licensing arrangements with many companies. So you might think a Mahiko is different from a Nath, is different from a Rallis, but ultimately they're all licensees of Monsanto. Vidarbha in Maharashtra is the worst hit. The acreage of BT has shot up to 2.8 million acres. One farmer is committing suicide every 6 hours in Vidarbha now.
Wow.
And Navdanya has started a campaign called Seeds of Hope, where we are distributing seeds to farmers, asking them to give up BT cotton because they have no other seed. They keep buying BT cotton because Monsanto has ensured there's a seed famine. Today, I will leave for a very historic place called Champaran, from where Gandhi started another satyagraha, another civil disobedience movement against the compulsory planting of indigo. Indigo used to be the blue dye, and Indian peasants could not grow food for themselves. They had to grow indigo for the British textile industry. I will start a two-week seed pilgrimage with my colleagues and farmers through 8 states of India. We will be distributing seeds, we will be saving seeds on the journey, and I believe as long as farmers have their own seed, they have not just seed freedom, but they have their food freedom and they have their food sovereignty. So we are bringing them seeds of food crops, we are bringing them seeds of non-BT cotton, and this is something your listeners could join, no matter where they are. Join the campaign of Seeds of Hope, contribute to helping farmers grow organic food, grow organic cotton, and through that, get out of the suicide trap. This movement for creating hope through GMO-free villages is a very, very important part of Navdanya's work.
So how deep is genetic modification reaching into the crops of India at the moment then, Vandana?
The genetically engineered BT cotton is the only crop that's grown on any commercial scale in India. They're trying to get into vegetables, but so far our movements and legal cases have prevented that from happening.
We're told that supermarkets are the fresh food people, but that's pretty hard to believe when you take a look at what they're putting on their shelves. Far from the fields of fresh veggies and fruit that we pine for, their products are increasingly jumping out of test tubes into our trolleys. Genetic engineering's one way, and our next guest has been examining another. Georgia Miller has just dropped into our airwaves, fresh from her latest report about the use of nanotechnology in food and agriculture. Before we take a look at what's on the shelves, Georgia, can you refresh our memories about nanotechnology, what it is, and why are you worried about it entering the food chain?
Nanotechnology is essentially the manipulation of materials at really, really small scales, several hundred times smaller than our body's blood cells. And the food industry is now using nanotechnology to produce a range of additives, as well as food packaging and a whole range of kitchen products. Nano is of interest to the food industry because it enables food companies to produce flavor additives, colour additives, odour additives that are much more potent and so can bring down food processing costs. It's also in use in a whole range of food processing aids, for example, additives that are used to make processed meat, and increasingly in packaging to help extend the shelf life of packaged food. Now, this is of concern to us because even though early scientific studies show that a lot of these nanomaterials now in use by the food industry do pose greater risk, none of them are required to go through new safety testing and none of them are labelled.
That's amazing stuff, and let's get on to both of those later in the interview. But when we last talked to you last year, Georgia, you were telling us that the trophy at that time for nanotechnology products was stain repellent pans. There was a lot of fine metal particles going into products and that was helping odour and stain repellency. Surely we're not talking about ingesting nanoparticles of copper and silver in food through packaging and food itself, are we?
Well, certainly it's true that nano silver is being used in a really bewildering array of food packaging products and also food contact materials, which is a big concern for us because nano silver is one of those nanomaterials about which we have the most serious safety concerns. Yet we're finding it in antibacterial chopping boards, refrigerators, food storage containers, and we have absolutely no idea whether or not the nano silver in these things is likely to come out of the food packaging into the food. We still don't actually have any published research that investigates this. So that's a big question mark and a big concern for us.
And I suppose the other concern with that is we're talking about such fine particles here, particles that can more easily penetrate our cells. I saw that nutritional supplements also contain nanotechnology as well. Tell us about that, because that seems to defy the whole notion of what we understand to be a nutritional supplement.
Absolutely. Look, I think most of us make what would seem to be a reasonable assumption that if you buy a nutritional supplement, it's safe and that it's actually going to deliver a health benefit. Now, nano throws that right into question because, unfortunately, there are increasingly nutritional supplements around the world that now contain manufactured nanoparticles about which fairly serious safety concerns exist. Now, the reason that manufacturers of these health supplements are including nanoparticles is because nanoparticles are known to be more potent than the same substance in larger form and also to have greater access to our body cells and tissues. On the one hand, that could be seen as delivering a health benefit because these things are so much more bioavailable, that is, available to our bodies. But it's entirely possible that these same properties actually introduce new safety hazards. And certainly the early scientific studies in this area do show that nanoparticles of substances like zinc and iron that we tend to think of as safe can actually be toxic in this very small form. The problem is we just don't have a very good understanding of how these nanoparticles behave in our bodies.
So we're talking about supermarkets being the fresh food people. What impacts is nanotechnology going to have on vegetables and fruit, Georgia?
Well, nanotechnology has a range of potential applications in food production, in agriculture. Firstly, nano is being used now to make more potent agrochemicals, pesticides, plant growth treatments, fertilizers. So it's being used to design nano-encapsulated active ingredients that can be released according to local environmental triggers. So, for example, if the capsule can be designed to release its contents in response to low nitrogen availability, in the future, it's predicted that more sophisticated nano-encapsulated pesticides and fertilizers and other active ingredients will be developed that will basically enable remote farm management, because they will essentially release their contents in response to whether it's a moisture stress or local weed development or a lack of micronutrients. And this, in conjunction with nano surveillance systems, is being predicted to offer the next wave of technology-enabled automation of agricultural and agricultural production. They could certainly enable much more efficient farming. So, for example, could accelerate trends toward large-scale, high-tech agricultural production that requires very little labour input. But they could also pose a whole bunch of really important social questions, like, what will this mean for our knowledge of farming techniques? Will, in a sense, nanotechnology turn into a financial product, some of the existing knowledge we have about farming, and embed it in a proprietary technology which people could come to depend on? What will this mean for struggling rural communities? You know, will this just be another development which actually ends up advantaging the larger agribusiness producers and makes it even harder for small farmers to compete?
To bring Vandana Shiva into our conversation now, Georgia. Vandana, we've been talking about a number of science-led threats to the food supply chain today. Genetic engineering, nanotechnology. Looking into your crystal ball, what's next on the horizon, do you think?
Well, I think the science horizon is going to split. There's going to be the reductionist science that's brought us the chemicals and then the genetic engineering and now nanotechnologies. And on the other side, there's going to be the holistic science that is bringing us ecological farming, good, healthy, wholesome processing, and the science of a holistic nutrition, a better integration of farming with health and the environment.
Yes.
And I believe the environmental crisis around agriculture, the food crisis, the obesity crisis, all kinds of food-related diseases are compelling humanity to step back and see whether leaving our food in the hands of corporations who bring new mysterious tools to manipulate our food and say this is high-tech, therefore trust us, whether people are going to trust them or not, I think will be a big issue of food freedom. We will have food freedom, or we will have food fascism with technologies being used as a way of controlling our food system.
Vandana, Georgia Miller, you've identified 104 products that have nanotechnology involved in their production. If somebody was offering me a pile of silver for eating, I wouldn't be taking it. So let's see what is actually around on those supermarket shelves at the moment.
Look, the first thing that we really need to be clear about is that there is so much secrecy surrounding the food industry's use of nano that people like you and me, in fact, any member of the public wandering down a supermarket aisle, has absolutely no basis to make an informed choice about whether or not to eat a nano food. So we really have a very limited knowledge of which food products on the supermarket shelves now contain nano and which don't. What we do know is that all the big food companies, Kraft, Nestle, Unilever, all have active nano research programs. Now, what we don't know is whether or not they're now using nano commercially in their food. Again, what we do know is that there are a handful of products whose manufacturers acknowledge nano content, and we've identified these in our report. They include things like diet replacement milkshakes, canola oil, tea, fortified fruit juice, even a fortified toddler food. We also know that there's another range of food additives that are being marketed by companies for use in things like processed meat, dairy products, bread, margarine, soft drink. But we don't know which of those breads or margarines or soft drinks actually are using nano now. And this is a big concern for groups like ours, because it's not just the general public which is left in the dark, but also food regulators, because food regulators internationally have no basis on which to know how many nanofoods are being sold in their jurisdictions, let alone how to ensure their safety.
And food packaging too. I mean, something that is very close to our food in terms of wraps. I see that the use of nano actually means that the adhesive quality of them requires less water and therefore less time and energy to wash and to dry. But the whole point that you're making with this is that's all very well. It might have a benefit, but the health impacts haven't been explored and we don't know. The labelling just isn't there. Tell us about the Food Safety Administration organisations around the world internationally and what they're saying about this. Why aren't they requiring business to label nanotechnology?
Food regulators are just being outpaced by the commercialisation of nano foods. So we're in this crazy situation where it's now 3.5 years since the world's oldest scientific institution, the United Kingdom's Royal Society, made very clear recommendations that nano ingredients should not be allowed for use in commercial products, not just food, but any commercial product, until they've gone through new rigorous safety testing and were labelled. And unfortunately, we still have governments failing to respond to those very clear calls for caution from very senior scientists. And food regulators continue to treat nanoparticles the same way they treat larger particles of the same substance. So what that means in practice is if a substance like zinc or iron or titanium dioxide has been approved for use as a larger particle in food, then even though you're producing nanoparticles for their novel properties, so for example, because they're more reactive, because they're more likely to get into our body cells and tissues, you are not required to go through new safety testing for those nanoparticles. This is a huge regulatory gap. So once again, we have a new technology which is being driven by commercial interests where public health and other public interest concerns rate a very small priority in the scheme of that technology's commercialisation.
That was Georgia Miller, who's the coordinator of Friends of the Earth Nanotechnology Project, talking about her latest report, Out of the Laboratory, Onto Our Plates. Georgia, where can people go to read more?
Visit our website. It's nano.foe.org.au, and we've got links to a whole range of other sources of information on nanotechnology.
Fascinating stuff, Georgia. Thank you. Vandana Shiva, I know that you're about to disappear into a meeting, but before you go, we're about to go to Western Sahara and learn about how Morocco continues to profit from the resources claimed by the people of Western Sahara. It's an issue about food sovereignty. One of the most surprising things about it, though, is that the international community could take a stand by not buying Western Sahara produce from Morocco, but they're not. Why don't governments take a stronger stance on where food comes from, do you think?
The reason governments don't take a strong stand about where food comes from is because governments are influenced both through power and money by giant corporations who would like to keep the food chain anonymous. Only the giant corporations benefit by people not knowing where the food comes from, how it was grown, how it was processed. Any democratic state would recognize that its duty to public health, its duty to protect the environment, requires that it brings to citizens the information of where is the food being produced and how was it produced.
Hear, hear. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to talk to you today, Vandana. Can we wish you all the best in the work that you are about to leave to do? And could you share with the new internationalists that are listening today where they might go for more information about the Seeds of Hope campaign?
If you want to find out more about Seeds of Hope or about Navdanya, go to www.navdanya.org. That's our website, and hopefully you'll find what you need. If you don't, write to me at vandana.shiva@gmail.com.
You're an inspiration, Vandana. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, and all the best.
Bye-bye, bye-bye.
And if you'd like to read more about Vandana's amazing work, she's profiled in the April edition of New Internationalist magazine. Go to www.newint.org, subscribe now, and get 3 issues of the magazine absolutely free. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. And today we're talking about why supermarkets aren't so super. On today's markets, all kinds of goods and services are flown from one end of the world to the other so that we can pop an ever-increasing array of goods into our shopping bags. And if it's not the products themselves, it's the stuff that goes into them. Like fertilisers, made from phosphates, which help grow fruit, vegetables and grains. Morocco is one of the world's biggest phosphate exporters, and its place in the global marketplace can create some unexpected results. Almost every time people in countries like Australia sit down at the dinner table, they're eating the fruits of Morocco's illegal invasion of Western Sahara. Western Saharan independence advocate Kamal Fadel has just dropped in to tell us why. Kamal, how important is phosphate and fertilisers in the production of the food that we eat and select in supermarkets?
Extremely important, because phosphate is used in probably over 90% of all the fertilisers that are used to produce food. And it seems that we have reached the
peak. Over 90%?
Yeah.
Well, that's huge, isn't it? I mean, essentially, almost every foodstuff you get in a supermarket then has a direct link with fertilizers.
Absolutely. Mm. And it seems that we have reached the peak of phosphate, because there isn't enough in the world of phosphate. And there is a strong advocacy for people to reconsider using phosphates in producing food and to look into alternatives.
Western Sahara is claimed by the Sahrawi people, but in 1975, when Spain moved out, Morocco moved in. We're talking here about a land area greater than Britain, mostly desert, with Morocco occupying 2/3 and independence fighters Polisario occupying 1/3. And there are no prizes for guessing who's occupying and profiting from the most resource-abundant areas of the country. What is the latest on the struggle for independence?
You mentioned that Western Sahara was invaded by Morocco and occupied in 1975. It is a big territory. It is very rich in mineral resources and in fishing. And so it's very enticing for Morocco to have invaded and occupied the territory and to keep it. The latest is that there is a process of negotiations and peace efforts by the United Nations in order to give a chance to the indigenous population of Western Sahara to vote and decide their own future in accordance with the United Nations resolutions and in accordance with the International Court of Justice verdict of 1975 and in accordance with many peace plans that have been accepted not only by the Sahrawis but also by Morocco itself under the United Nations auspices. Morocco realized very quickly that should they go towards the referendum and allow it, a free and fair referendum in accordance with the United Nations resolutions and peace plan, they would lose it.
Yes, there isn't any doubt about that, really, is there? What's the latest on moving Morocco forward? The last time I looked, it's very hard to actually see inside Western Sahara. There were some disturbing human rights abuses taking place in the country. Can you tell us about those, Kamal?
Yes, it is terrible. Since the beginning of the conflict, Morocco has not allowed free speech in Western Sahara. It has kept the country sealed from the international community, not allowing independent observers or the media. Nonetheless, the Sahrawis have been trying to raise their voices and very courageous and brave also to raise the flag, which is not allowed in Western Sahara. And there has been an uprising, a very major one since 2005, where people are almost on a daily basis demonstrating, saying that they want independence and they want freedom and they want the respect of their rights. And the response they get is very brutal and terrible from the Moroccans, where they torture people, put them in jail for long terms. And while this is also happening, we have to remind people about the wall, the berm that Morocco built which is 2,400 kilometers long, with 3 to 5 million landmines, with barbed wires, trenches, rocks, radars, dogs, and 140,000 Moroccan soldiers to divide the occupied area from the liberated area so that people cannot cross or run away from the territory. So it's a huge construction, and it costs Morocco about $2 million on a daily basis.
So what's in it for Morocco? Of course, territory, and one would think the resources in the territory. What resources are there in the territory?
Yeah, Western Sahara is very rich in fishing.
Yes.
And its coast is 1,500 kilometers long, very renowned because the fish migrate to the coast of Western Sahara because of the warm waters, and the European fleets fish there, the Japanese, the Russians, and also there is a great potential for oil. Oil companies have said, because of the explorations that has been done, this territory is very promising, and they want to come there and prospect for oil. The phosphates, iron ore, zinc, uranium, possibility of gold, and phosphate, Morocco is getting a lot of money out of it. And this is terrible because we have this problem where there are illegal occupation, human rights abuses, an absolute monarchy and regime in Morocco, a dictatorship, and the UN has said clearly that no country should deal with Morocco regarding the resources of Western Sahara. It is illegal to exploit the resources of a non-self-governing territory like Western Sahara. It is unethical, immoral, and illegal.
Mm. In 2006, the European Union signed an agreement with Morocco about exploiting the fishing resources of Western Sahara. I mean, when I read that, I thought, that's a snub to the Sahrawis. What are the diplomats within the European Union saying about that?
Well, there was a strong debate, and I must mention that the Scandinavians and, for example, the Irish voiced their disagreement about dealing with fishing in Western Sahara, and they wanted to separate contracts or deals or agreements between Morocco itself and the European Union, and they wanted to keep Western Sahara outside that agreement. I think Sweden, for example, voted against the agreement.
Mm.
It is terrible. It is unbelievable. It is a scandal, really.
It sounds like the worst kind of hypocrisy, actually,
yes.
Because the UN does support the taking of a referendum in Western Sahara.
It is also greed. There are countries who are benefiting a lot, like Spain and to some extent Portugal, from fishing in Western Sahara, and they wanted to push this deal without any consideration to the legality of it or to the ethical and moral stance.
Now, is that the kind of fish that we're likely to see on our plates?
Absolutely. And I think there is now a strong campaign internationally, particularly in Scandinavia and other European countries, because this money that Morocco gets out of these deals is taken by the royal family, given to the cronies, and also distributed amongst the generals.
Mm.
And it could have been used to buy arms.
To be used against the Western Saharans.
The Western Saharan peoples and oppression, you know, materials, because Morocco is buying these equipments to counter the demonstrations, the batons, the cars that are used by the police and the paramilitaries in Western Sahara are bought by money which Morocco cannot afford.
Mm.
Morocco itself does not have many resources, so it uses the fishing and the phosphates in Western Sahara in order to gain money that is also used against the Sahrawi people.
That was Kamal Fadel from Polisario, the independence advocates for the Western Saharan people. Well, Kamal, we wish you well and the Sahrawi people well in their struggle for independence. And will you come back and talk to us soon about how a nation arises in terms of fighting for its independence and then taking its position as a legitimate member on the world stage of nations?
I would certainly do that.
And as it turns out, Kamal's just fished out the last issue that we're exploring on today's program about the not-so-super supermarkets. You'll be pleased to know that you won't find the music that we've been playing today on any supermarket shelves. It's from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today's CD is called Mahima, an extraordinary melting pot of music by two of the world's best slide guitarists, Debashish Bhattacharya from India and Bob Brosman, bringing in his signature strains from the Pacific. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. This program's associate producer is Rachel Maher. I'm Chris Richards. Speak with you soon.